That's one of those songs that, thank you for trying as hard as you could. We have to earn singing some songs. And let me tell you, you would know that you earned it if you ever went and helped in any of that work we've done. And you also would know that, man, I need to learn how to sing better. I want to say that for those of you who are reading Robin DiAngelo's White Fragility and why it's so hard for white people to talk about racism, that she does give some words of encouragement toward the end. She has found that people of color don't abandon her when she asks them to help her see her racism, especially when she's teaching and counseling others. And she has learned to listen with respect, repeat back those behaviors without defensiveness, and to apologize. Now, I don't recommend that you walk up to just anyone on a street corner to have this conversation. Nor should you tackle down the one or two people of color you might know and ask them to become your teacher. Please remember that. Some people are laughing because it's just not funny. It's just not. This is why you're reading that book, by the way, to learn some skills and how to address these serious issues that Melissa talked about and how to live out our principles. You have to have some kind of relationship at work or at church or perhaps in the world of justice making. And her book, If You're White, makes us squirm because there is no place to avoid the reality of the world we swim in and how we have tried to protect ourselves and, as she says, tried to be innocent of any racism personally. And when our stereotypes and aggressions, I'm not going to call them microaggressions, are challenged, we wilt, become defensive, hurt, offended, teary-eyed, belligerent, huffy, fragile, as if we're going to fall apart. But I believe that we are made of sterner stuff than this. Surely we can take the truth and recommit ourselves to becoming more real, more authentic, and refusing to be complicit with the hatred in our society. I have made just about every mistake, she points out, including, and not even that long ago, that I somehow thought that I would get a pass on my racism because I have two sons-in-law of color. Now, this is just downright embarrassing for me. And I don't know if I'm going to talk about it around the dinner table or not. But I'm just, and I never said that out loud, but I thought that. I thought, I have a pass here. I do know, though, that my fervor for their safety and that my grandchildren might grow up in a better world is real. But it doesn't prove I'm not racist or that I'm not privileged because of the color of my skin. The greatest gift of my work with Together Colorado over the last 5 years or so has not been my ability to make a difference, but the opportunity to get to know people outside of my suburban bubble. As a matter of fact, my thinking, to the degree I had it, that I could do good was one of the most important inner obstacles I had to overcome. Fortunately, I have never been completely superficial or clueless, and I am blessed with some skills, empathy, and I'm thankful that I'm an introvert, because that usually helps me feel and see what's going on around me before I might open my mouth and insert my foot. I have learned that the black and brown activists that I know do not need help or affirmation from whites. They need people who also have a stake in the justice they seek, people who also care and who will cry when a child or loved one is hurt. They do not need a bunch of busybodies out there doing good. And for them, it is literally, for many of them, a matter of life and death. And there are weekly, even daily reminders. They have no patience for whatever this stuff is that we're working on. While we worked on passing Amendment A this past fall, which was taking the exception to slavery out of the Colorado Constitution, which is still there in the 13th Amendment, and in my opinion, why our justice system, our criminal justice system, is such a nightmare, one fellow African-American minister and mother to a 17-year-old son had to fight wrongful criminal charges that he had tried to steal a car one night. He was literally arrested because he was young and black and wearing a hoodie that had some black on it as he walked home from the bus stop. He did not do it, and eventually the judge dismissed the case. But why did she and her family have to suffer through this just as he was graduating from high school and planning his future? Then, listening to the news one day this month, I heard that maternal death rates are up in the United States, especially among black women. While maternal death rates are declining in most parts of the world, the rate in the United States has more than doubled since 1987, according to the World Health Organization, and black women are 3 to 4 times more likely to die. 3 or 4 times more likely to die than white women when they have complications, according to the Center for Disease Control. Now, no one has a good answer as to why, but in talking with the people I know, it's not hard to imagine all the reasons a black woman might not be given the same care or be listened to quite as carefully as a white woman. Over these 20 years of sermons recognizing Martin Luther King Jr. Day, we have no doubt here at Prairie contributed to the feel-good notion that racism is a thing of the past. My ILF professor, the late Vincent Harding, who worked with King, knew that King's legacy would become a glossy footnote instead of a continued challenge. And so our Unitarian Universalist activist of color asked all of our churches this year to not even quote King during our services, especially not the I Have a Dream speech. A silver lining of our times is that most of us can see now the blatant racism that had been lying just beneath the surface, and why more of us are not up in arms about children being taken from their families at our border is a mystery to me, except that it isn't. That is how strongly the lines are drawn between what happens to white people versus some black, brown, or Indian people. I would like you to disagree with me on that and tell me why, truly. Eddie Glaw Jr., the William S. Todd Professor of Religion and African American Studies at Princeton, and a sometimes commentator on MSNBC, wrote an article last year on how bone-deep depressed King became in the last few years of his life. Probably why he asked that Precious Lord Take My Hand be played that night at the rally before he was killed. He was in Grenada, Mississippi, and he could not get out of his bed on September 20th, 1966. They had been working with the Southern Christian Leadership Conference to desegregate John Rundle High School and Lizzie Horn Elementary, and an angry mob had gathered outside. The white students had been dismissed midday, and half an hour later, the black students emerged. Grown men descended upon 12-year-old Richard Tsai and broke his leg with lead pipes while others laughed and pummeled a little girl in pigtails. Glaude writes, "Near the end of his life, King confronted the uncertainty of his moral vision. He had underestimated how deeply the belief that white people matter more than others, what I call the value gap, was ingrained in the habits of American life. He saw that white resentment involved more than fatigue with mass demonstrations and demands for racial equality, and was not simply a sin of the South. It was embedded in the very psyche of white America." In King's final book, drafted in 1967, called Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos or Community, he argued that white supremacy stood in the way of American democracy and that it was an ever-present force against black and brown Americans. There is at the heart of our country, too, a distorted understanding of the meaning of racial justice. King wrote, and I think Black Lives UU will forgive me for quoting him here, "Negroes have proceeded from a premise that equality means what it says, and they have taken white Americans at their word when they talked of it as an objective. But most whites in America proceed from a premise that equality is a loose expression of improvement. White America is not even psychologically organized to close the gap. Essentially, it seeks only to make it less painful and less obvious, but in most respects to retain it." We live in a world where white people do good for black people, Glaud writes, creating that illusion of innocence, while inequality remains solidly in place. Home ownership among African Americans is just over 40%, 30 points behind the rate of whites. Public schools are as racially segregated today as they were in the 1960s. Black kids are three times as likely to be poor as white kids. Black unemployment remains roughly twice that of white unemployment. And the wealth gap between black and white Americans has tripled over the last century. What I have come to see is that there are different realities in our country. There is a white reality, a black reality, a brown reality, an Asian reality, and an American Indian reality. And we do not all live in the same world or on the same plane. We do not have the same experience of our country. If you are white, learning to see this and how you collude with or accept things as they are, or even secretly or not so secretly believe that you are better, superior, smarter, brighter, work harder, etc., that requires a transformation of the heart and mind. You cannot simply will yourself into becoming anti-racist. You must go through the difficult and uncomfortable steps of seeing how your reality has been protected or shielded from other realities. How that for most of us here today, but not all, everything about our history telling to our cultural understandings is embedded in a glossy white trope. Movies, education, healthcare, employment, everything. I really want you to read that book. If for no other reason, to reconsider the movie The Blind Side. That's all I'm going to say about it. Reread that book. The good news is that this transformation is not unlike other kinds of religious and faith transformations. One day when you were young, maybe, you believed in a God on a mountain that sent some to hell and others to heaven. And then you might have left that religion behind and walked maybe a long time in the wilderness. And then you came to believe, perhaps, in the inherent worth and dignity of every person, that everyone was created with the same inner spark within, that everyone is part of the universe and is made up of stardust, that beauty and love are forces within everyone's hearts. And you began looking for that spark within you, and then you began looking at it for it within others, in every other that you met. And you found that it was true, or at least as true as anything gets. However you might express your universal beliefs, we need a faith that leads us out of the quagmire we find ourselves in. We cannot simply become depressed or give up. We must recommit ourselves again today and every day, just as Melissa said, to a different moral vision and realize that it has not yet come to pass. We will make 1,000 mistakes. We cannot help it. That's how we've been trained. But piece by piece, we can deconstruct the evil and the cruelty, and we can learn to walk together with others to create a different reality. And let me tell you, you need a practice like prayer, because you are going to need all the strength and wisdom and forgiveness you can find for yourself and for one another. For those of us who have had religious or similar transformations, remember the hypocrisy that you saw all around you. Let's face that hypocrisy now in our justice work. Face it when we find it within us, and address it when we find it without. Let's stop simply doing good for others and realize that our very lives and the lives of our children and grandchildren are at stake. And may we stand for anti-racism, anti-hate, anti-white supremacy, and work for one another's real salvation, and really learn to mean it when we say we want a more just, fair, and equal world. Amen. Let's take that out on the streets. That's what a community does. Let's build our own hearts and go out there and make a difference where we can. And that is almost everywhere you go. Let us now continue in our support for this amazing community. And our choir comes forth as we receive our morning's offering.